Hi, this is Daniel. This is not a normal Dubious Intent show. I'm just going to let you know this right up front. Adam's out of town, but for whatever reason, I decided to go on the stream Sunday night in our normal time slot and talk about politics. This is a recording of that stream of consciousness, I guess, is what you would call it. Anyway, something new, something different for you to listen to. If you don't like it, that's fine. Skip past it. If you do like it, send me an email. Maybe we'll do more. We now join the Sunday night stream already in progress. Parker in the chat room wants to know, have I seen the video where they extract the raw materials of YouTube? Of Oreos. Raw materials of Oreos. I'm searching for this now. Is it called How It's Unmade? Is that what I'm looking for? Oh, you've provided me with a helpful link. How very fair. I am now going to open up this link that Parker... Oh my God. I just said open up. Open up. You guys don't know I do a little dance every time I do that. Let's see what Parker has.
Oreos, a vital part of any nutritious breakfast. But did you know that some companies harvest them for raw materials? This factory does just that. Packages of cookies are fed into a rotosiller that bonds the wrappers together. The wrappers are then stripped off by a tug puller. Rollers collect them for reuse as Vancouver building insulation.
What?
Unleaded Oreos are sent on one path, and leaded Oreos are sent on the other.
Leaded?
Powerful vacuums pull the cookies off the line.
Oh, I see.
Magnetic grabbers collect the cookies from the plastic.
I see. I don't think this goes without the video. You'd have to actually watch the link that Parker has. By the way, I'm trying desperately to use my mouse, and my youngest cat is laying on my desk and has, you know, her butt is right next to my mouse pad, and so her tail is just swatting me here. Now, they're normally not this clingy, but I've been camping since Friday, so I've been gone for 2 days, and so now they're very much attached to my hip. It's a very clever video where they take the Oreo assembly line and then play it backwards so that you see all that stuff. So thank you, Parker. Thank you for opening our eyes to that. You know I'm going to use any excuse to say open, right?
Open up. Open up. Open up. Open up to all the excitement. The world at your fingertips.
I want to send that to Flat 22 and see if they will actually like record me a modern version of that. Damn you, FL Mac. You have given me an earworm that I cannot shake. I cannot shake it. So on the Dubious Intent show, we don't ever talk about politics. But as I was saying earlier, I started out. That's how I started in podcasting, was by doing political talk. At the time, I was a member of the Progressive Podcast Network. A million billion moons ago. I'm trying to think what presidential election that was. Was it? It must have been Obama's first election. Nico in the chat room says that it was the FDR. Yeah, it was FDR was, in fact, the president that I first did my political podcast with. We didn't have any kind of recording medium back then, though, so I would actually do it on 8-tracks, and I'd have to mail them out to people. Anyway, so I did a political show called Callback 7, and I used to talk about politics all the time. One of my secret weapon, by the way, for doing a political show, because by the way, doing a political show is a lot of work. Like, to make sure that you don't just show up and just like talk out of your ass, right? Just like not say stupid things. And trust me, there's a lot of homegrown political podcasts that I listen to that is like, that y'all, wow, you're so wrong. Or you just have your facts wrong. You know what I'm saying? Just like, it isn't even a matter of this isn't your opinion. You actually, what you're opining on is actually factually incorrect. So in order to make sure that you don't, like, you know, end up talking out of your ass, you spend a lot of time reading and catching up and making sure that what you're going to say is true. It was just a lot of work. And what my secret weapon during that time was the Rachel Maddow Show, which was only available on Air America. So you had to be a serious subscriber and actually have access to Air America so you could listen to that. So it's like, this was back before anyone knew who Rachel Maddow was. So it's like, she would make some really great points that I would just steal. It was great. She's like my little secret weapon back then. But Air America was great. Don't let anyone buffalo you into thinking that it was like this horrible, huge failure of a thing. It was a failure of a thing because the people that funded Air America, the people that did it, funded it on a short term, like a 2-year basis. Like, they wanted this network to be like fully up and running and producing profit within a 2-year period, which is just something that's not possible to do. And the amount of money that they said that they had bankrolling them was a lie. They didn't actually have that money bankrolling them. So it ended up with Air America basically just having to like shut its doors one day, quite unexpectedly, because the uppity ups had been lying about their funding the entire time. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But you think back to like the things that came out of Air America. It's like the Rachel Maddow came out of Air America. Al Franken came out of Air America. I mean, obviously he had a comedy career before that, a writing career before that. But I mean, that's where he launched his senatorial campaign, was on Air America. Tom Malloy. Did I get that right? Tom Malloy? No, Mike Malloy. Mike Malloy, just a long time. Randy Rhodes. Who am I forgetting? Not Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman was always independent. Anyway, so all of this is which to say I used to talk about politics a lot. And I don't do it a lot anymore because, I mean, I talk about politics. I just don't talk about them on a podcast because, I mean, it's just not what we do. However, there's this whole thing, right? These two big things, these two big political events, the RNC, the DNC, two solid weeks of politics. It was great. For people that love politics, it was great. I lost so much fucking sleep over the past 2 weeks. I had MSNBC on almost constantly. I had C-SPAN on a different TV constantly. An independent podcaster, Justin Robert Young from the Diamond Club, who had gotten hired by BitTorrent News to do their political coverage because BitTorrent News was trying to launch their service. So when I could, I watched it because, by the way, their service really sucks. Just not steady at all. So it's like trying to maintain it. It's like, it was such a great, the stuff that I did get to see from them was really good, but then it would just be completely destroyed by the fact that it was like, it was buffering and it couldn't stream out to a number of people. Yasmin Badu was pointing out that Janine Garofalo had a show on Air America. She did. It was called The Majority Report. And in fact, it still exists to this day. Sam Cedar, her co-host on that, still does The Majority Report as a YouTube show now. So you can actually still watch Sam Cedar on YouTube do The Majority. He has a really whiny voice, though. I was just never a Sam Cedar fan. Mark Maron started on Air America. That's where he started doing his whole political thing. He did the morning show on Air America. So Mark Maron of WTF fame. Air America had a lot of great talent. It was certainly not a lack of talent that made Air America fail, and it certainly wasn't a lack of interest of people listening to them, because these people have all gone on to be incredibly successful in their own right. It was just, you know, the expectation of, you really had to have satellite radio to listen to them. They did not leverage the internet in the way that they should have at this time, because this was really kind of like the dawn of podcasting and stuff, where it's like people were shying away from internet. From satellite radio. It's like, wait, why should I pay $12 a month for satellite radio when I can, like, you know, listen to this on the internet as a podcast and put it on my iPod and stuff like that. Parker in the chat room is saying that he didn't like how Sam Cedar interrupted Janine Garofalo. He never forgave her that. You know, one of the things I found most interesting on that was that Sam Cedar would often make jokes that required you to know him. Let me think, how do I say this? In other words, like, he would make a joke about some minority, which if you knew Sam Cedar, you would know that he was joking, but he did it in such a dry way that if you didn't know Sam Cedar, you would assume that he was somehow against that minority, like that he was racist or sexist or ageist or whatever. And I remember Janine oftentimes correcting him in them and was like, we don't have the capital to do that yet. It's like, you know, we've only been doing this show for 6 months. They don't know us well enough for us to be able to do those kinds of jokes yet. It's like you're jumping the ball there. And so I always enjoyed that particular interaction because she would get pissed. You could just tell she was pissed. There's a part of me that thinks that he just wanted to get her pissed. Anyway, so I had all of this stuff set up in my house. I was watching MSNBC. I was watching C-SPAN. I was like piping, you know, everything that I could. It's like, I don't have cable in my bedroom. I only have an Amazon Fire TV. So I was like watching things, you know, streaming through there. I will admit that at certain times I took over the Pride 48 stream late at night and early in the morning during the day, where I would pipe the audio through MSNBC in there. And that was basically so that I could hear the audio from MSNBC as I was going to bed at night. I will cop to that. Anyway, two amazing, amazing weeks of politics just unfurled in front of us. The Republican National, it was such a weird convention. And I know that you've already heard everyone talk about it, you know, 1,000 different ways from Sunday. It was just such a weird... It's just weird. But I think conventions in general are weird, because the thing that I, you know, found most shocking, A, was, you know, here was Donald Trump showing up the first night. He basically showed up, and that was the night that he did the We Are the Champions intro to go out there and say hi and everything. It's like, traditionally, the candidate at a convention doesn't show up until the last night. But, you know, in this one, he was there like every night. He was just kept showing up. Like when Ted Cruz was getting booed off stage, Donald Trump was, you know, walking into the back of the room there and going in to watch his son speak or whatever. One of the things I thought was most interesting about the Republican National Convention is the hatred that these people exude. And before I talk about it, I mean, you could see it on their face. I mean, when people would get them riled up, like when Giuliani was out there getting them riled up and everything, you know, they would cut to crowd shots and everything. And you would see these people that had scary looking hate in their eyes, like scary looking, like these are the kind of people that if you ran into, you know, in the grocery store screaming at you like that, you would be backing away from. He's like, whoa, something's about to go on. You know, something's about to happen here. Because I don't like the look in that eye. You know, every evolutional tingle in your body that your little monkey brain has been primed since birth to recognize danger, you know, from another thing, like there's a reason, right, that universally a baby crying is annoying. It's because we're genetically predisposed to like react to a baby crying because it helped propagate our species, yada yada. But there are universal danger signs that we are all familiar with. We don't have to be taught them, right? Like an animal baring its teeth and growling at you is you have to learn the fact that, oh, holy shit, that thing's gonna, you know, something's going down here. This is just millions of years of evolution have primed us to this. And when you saw those faces on the, you know, as they would cut to the crowd, you know, that was the reaction that I got to myself. Like, holy shit. It's like that something's going down here. There's going to be some fisticuffs, if I can steal that phrase from Joe Biden. I don't know that he said that, but I'm sure he would. But before we talk about that, because there was a lot of that on the Democratic side too, not hatred and stuff, but just intensity, the intensity of the crowd at these conventions. And there was a lot of speak about the intensity of the crowds at the convention, specifically the Bernie Sanders supporters, or the Bernie or bust people over on the Democratic side. But I think it's important to recognize, at least from a quasi-neutral standpoint, these are delegates. These are not your average Joe voter that ended up, you know, hey, I'm in Cleveland, I'm just going to go to the convention and everything. These are people that fought for their position to be there. These are people that, you know, were phone banking and showing up and, you know, going door to door and helping their candidate, going out and fundraising and contributing and stuff. These are really passionate people. These are the delegates. These are the people, you know, the internal machinations of both parties, right? These are the cogs. These are the things that they, of course, they're more psyched up. They're more intense than your general population. And I think trying to extrapolate out the fact that, you know, that these Bernie or bust people were really super vocal and really super pissed, to try to extrapolate that out and just saying that like all Bernie Sanders supporters are this way, especially when you have polls telling you the exact opposite, right? The polls are telling you that 85 to 90% of Bernie Sanders supporters are absolutely already going to vote for Hillary. There's not a question about that. It's really just a fight for that last 10 to 15% of his supporters. Regardless, though, I just wanted to throw that out there. So even though I'm seeing these Republicans look super, super scary at time, I have to remind myself, that's not all Republicans. There's a lot of decent Republicans out there. My parents are Republicans. I'm from a small southern town. There's a lot of people there that are Republicans. And they're not crazy. They're genuinely nice people. They happen to have different values. They happen to have different beliefs. And that's fine. Right? That's what this country is all about. We can all have different beliefs. We can all have different opinions on things. The important part is that we have to at least respect the system that allows us to navigate those difference of beliefs through compromise and through, diplomacy, I guess. And I think that's eroding in this country. I think that recognition of the fact that we are all here together and that we're all eventually, have a mutual goal of survival, and that sometimes we're going to win and sometimes we're going to lose. I think that is rapidly eroding from our system. And it's the point that I was making earlier that I cut myself off from, but I will now circle back to. So we're in the age of media, where the concept of political discourse, of what we've come to understand as political discourse, is two people 180 degrees apart from each other on any given topic. So if we're going to talk about gun control, you can be assured that on one side you're going to have someone who owns 700 guns and believes that you should be able to take them to elementary school with you. And on the other side, you're going to have someone who only eats food that was shot with a bow and arrow and is completely against any form of firearm in any situation. And the moderator is going to sit in the middle and say, well, gun control is a big issue. What do you say, you? And then they're going to both start screaming at each other because they have about 90 seconds to actually get their point out in what is basically going to be about a 4 or 5 minute segment, because that's about how long the American public's attention span is. So in order to keep your attention, right, we have to make it entertaining, because we deregulated the news industry, right? Because news now has to create a profit. So we have these people who are just screaming at each other, and that is like, there's entire generations. Maybe not too many generations, but at least one, if not two generations of the American public that have grown up in this environment. That is their norm. That is their norm, is to see two people screaming at each other about politics. So when they say, oh, I hate politics, I don't like to talk about it, oh, I hate talking about politics, that's because that's what they're talking about. They hate that extreme view. But if you really think about it, most of us are somewhere in the middle. We're really not so impassioned about guns that we have 700 of them stuffed in our house, nor are we completely against them. Most of us fall somewhere in the middle. I would prefer that maybe, automatic rifles or these huge magazines of bullets, like where you can have, 600 bullets in a single magazine. Maybe those aren't the greatest idea. Maybe we could restrict those. But in general, I'm not opposed to somebody owning a gun or a rifle or something like that. I mean, my nephews hunt. I can understand that. That's fine. But that's what we've come to understand as political discourse, is these two disparate sides screaming at each other. And I think because of that, the whole recognition of the fact that we're in this together has started to erode. And that is reflected in the faces of these delegates, right? They're like a little bellwether here, right? These are the most impassioned people on both sides. And when you start to see them go batshit crazy, how much longer is it going to be before the general populace is behind them going batshit crazy as well? I mean, you already see this now at Trump rallies, where people are getting beat up. Hell, you see this just in the news daily, like people getting shot by cops, laying on the ground with their hands in the air. screaming out in a very articulate voice, "I am a mental health care worker. I am unharmed. Please do not shoot me." And when they asked the cop why he shot him, his answer was, "I don't know." That since changed, by the way, if you've read the news on that. So his spokesman has now fed him the line of, like, he was actually trying to shoot the other guy, which would have been the, mentally disabled guy playing with his toy truck. So he's trying to shoot the mentally disabled guy. He wasn't trying to shoot the black guy on the ground with his arms up. No, he was trying to shoot the other guy, which is no better, really. Why are we shooting at all? But I digress. The Republican convention started. Oh, I'm sorry. Parker is asking in the chat room, was that actually his answer? Yes, I swear to God. Look it up. Yes, that actually was his answer when initially asked why he shot the guy. He's like, "I don't know." The Republican convention is one of those things. It touches the things that the modern Republican Party stands for, at least the things that are written into their platform. It's just things that I don't agree with. I believe in a woman. I believe a woman has a right to choose whether to have an abortion or not. That's just something that I believe. They don't. I believe that there should be some restrictions on gun control, on gun ownership, and they do not. These are things that I disagree with them on, and that's fine, right? I believe that trickle-down economics doesn't work. And, like, providing rich people with tax breaks that is somehow going to cause them to create jobs is a complete and utter myth that at least 30 years of our own history has proven to be false. Right? I mean, the most infuriating thing in the world, I'm sorry, I'm going to digress here for a minute, but the most infuriating thing in the world to me is when I hear, it's like, well, rich people, they're the job creators. It's like, I always just want to look at it. So if I give you $1 million, how many people are you going to hire? None. Right? Money doesn't create jobs. You having money doesn't create jobs. The thing that creates jobs, the thing that has always created jobs, which is demand for something. Right? There's a demand for widgets. And so, I can make widgets. And I'm selling these widgets and making money. So therefore, I need to hire someone to help me make more widgets. It's a demand. It's a supply and demand thing. It's a very basic, simple thing to follow. This myth, right? I'm going to go win the lottery tomorrow, and I'm going to start hiring people, right? Because, hey, I'm wealthy now. I'm a job creator. So listening to the Republican folks, you know, I wasn't really swayed by any of them. Until Donald Trump got up. Thursday night. Donald Trump speaking at the Republican National Convention started saying things that kind of agree with, right? We need to spend more money on our infrastructure. Yeah, I agree with that. We need to get big money out of politics. Yeah, I agree with that. But the things that he was saying were couched in the middle. It was like navigating some kind of mental minefield, right? It's just kind of like, we should improve the infrastructure of our country. Yay. And kill all the black people. Oh, it's just like, whoa. It's just like kind of one of those things like, wow, this is crazy. The guy spoke for 75 minutes. But there were points during that speech that I was like, he's not that bad. Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I kind of see why people would go for that. I mean, the outrageously insane racist parts of it, not. But that's me, right? I'm hypersensitive to that kind of stuff. I could see a lot of people aren't. A lot of people feel, whether it's right or not, a lot of people feel that they're, you know, somehow... All right, let's be perfectly honest. A lot of white people feel as though their freedom to say things is being restricted in some way, and they've somehow logically twisted this to to, you know, in some kind of mental ball of anger towards people of different races. They don't know how. They can't explain to you how it works. Like a warp drive in a J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie. We don't know how it works. There's books written about it, but fuck that. We're going to make it do this thing. But they are very... if you can get past the crazy... I guess my point is, if you can get past the crazy racist stuff, if you don't see it as being a crazy racist thing, then yeah, what Donald Trump says is kind of appealing, right? 60% of this country thinks that we're going in the wrong track. 60% of the country. So if you know that 60% of the country thinks that we're going in the wrong track, they have no idea why. They can't tell you why things are going in the wrong track. Crime is down. Job market is recovering. Violent crimes are down. Crime is down in general. But they can't tell you. They can't tell you why they feel as though everything's going the wrong track. They just know that everything's going in the wrong track. Spoiler alert, there's a black guy in the White House and that pisses them off. Anyway, I don't like to talk about it, but I do have a degree in psychology. I get it. I get the appeal of the Donald Trump speech. I mean, I could see how people could be willing to excuse his crazy antics because they're like, we really need a shakeup. You know, this country is going in the wrong, by the way, this is a hypothetical speak. This is not me speaking. This is like a hypothetical person that is being attracted to Donald Trump going, you know what? The country is going in the wrong direction. I feel this in my bones. And I can't tell you why. I can't tell you how, but I can tell you that these people keep getting reelected saying that they're going to make things different and they don't. And they're all part of this big machinery thing, these big party systems. And they all have these internal things that I don't like to think about. And I don't want to know how that works or whatever. And it's like, here's a guy that's not part of that. Look at that. Look at him. Look at him. He made his own money. He made his own way. He's saying that he knows what he can do. Well, these other guys over here clearly don't know what the fuck they're doing. So yeah, let's give this guy a chance. Let's give this guy a chance. Right? Let's give this guy a chance. How much worse could he be? That's the feeling, right? That's the Republican Party right now in a nutshell. Aside from your incredibly, you know, dogged right-wing extremists, which, by the way, I don't think are really for Trump that much. They're kind of pissed off about the whole Ted Cruz thing. But that was the Republican convention. A bunch of people just ginning up fear. And then a guy coming out and saying that he's going to fix it. And a bunch of people believing it. That's fine. But then it became time for the Democrats. The Democrats are going to have their convention. Yay! Philadelphia. Chris Matthews sitting out in front of Independence Hall, speaking out on the lawn. By the way, Chris Matthews, by the way, just an aside, Chris Matthews has the most bizarre balloon fetish you've ever heard of in your life. He's obsessed. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, the balloons, the Republicans know how to make balloons fall. The Democrats, not so good. I don't know why. I don't know where he came up with that, but he's just got a crazy balloon fetish. We get to the Democratic convention. And I'm kind of like, I'm going to be honest here. Now, again, remember, it's okay if we don't all agree on everything. I'm not super jazzed about Hillary. Haven't been super jazzed about Hillary for a long time. Not for the insane reasons that people like to point out. Like people like to point out that, oh, she's corrupt. She's a liar. She's horrible. But it's none of that. It's none of that. These are politicians. These are diplomats. These are people that do their jobs under incredible scrutiny. Dealing with an opposing party that is just there to pounce on any kind of an opportunity to exploit something that they've done wrong. Think about if you had to do your job that way. Think about all the little shortcuts that you might have done in your job, right? Like maybe you sat in your cubicle and watched Netflix a day or two instead of doing something that you were supposed to be doing. Maybe you snuck out of the office and had a 2-hour lunch instead of the 30 minutes you were supposed to have. right? Whatever. You do little things all the time. Maybe you just didn't want to answer a fucking email and you said, oh, I never got it. Things like that. But you're doing those in your job. You're not doing those in front of the public. You're not doing that in front of like this incredible scrutiny. So to me, the whole corruptness part of Hillary is one of those things that she's been in public life for 40 years. The fact that there's not more of this means that she's probably not that bad, right? I mean, to have every single day under a microscope and have every little thing you do being made into such a huge deal. I believe the line now on Benghazi, which, by the way, most people can't even point to on a map. Half of them don't even know it's an actual city. It's like when you talk about Benghazi, it's like, it's escalated now. She's put the entire security of the United States in jeopardy by this. By this whole failure in Benghazi. Whoa, really? What did she fail on? Well, she didn't assign the security people or something. I'm not really sure, but she did it. They don't know. Hillary Clinton had my respect when she sat in front of a Senate committee answering questions about Benghazi, and she sat there for some insane fucking period of time. I don't even remember what it was, but it was multiple hours, like 7, 8, maybe more hours that she sat in front of this panel asking her the most insane, stupid questions and sat there and answered them calmly and answered them, you know, in the way they wanted. So I don't have a problem with Hillary Clinton as far as like thinking that she's corrupt or thinking that she's crazy. The problem that I have with Hillary Clinton is that she tends to be very Republican. Look at how she responds to things, right? Look at how she responds to Donald Trump and she pivots back to, strong military, these are Republican talking points, right? A strong, I will keep our military strong. I will protect you. I've often said that Bill Clinton was the best Republican president we've ever had. So that's kind of my problem with Hillary, is that she's a bit too far to the right for me. But that's just me. I don't really have a huge, huge problem with her as a person. Certainly don't have a problem with her being a woman. Just a little bit too Republican for me. So I'm going into this Democratic convention thinking to myself, all right, what's going to happen here? Because, for the most part, probably just going to leave the box for president blank, right? Probably not going to vote for Hillary. Probably just going to skip that section. Still vote for, Congress and Senate and state Senate and all the things that matter. Probably just going to leave that little box of president blank. Now, I live in Connecticut, so not really a big, huge chance that she's not going to take the state. There's not a whole lot of risk in that strategy for me. But I figure, all right, I'll tune in. I'll see what's going to happen here. First night of Democratic convention. Michelle Obama comes out. Actually, no, let's stop that. I think Michelle Obama, before we get to Michelle Obama, she was preceded by Cory Booker. Cory Booker gave what in any other year, in any other event, would have been an amazing Hallmark speech. People would have been talking about Cory Booker as here's Cory Booker. He's following in Obama's footsteps. You know, a young guy showing up at the Democratic convention and giving an amazing speech and generating a lot of buzz. And that would have been great if not even five minutes after he left that stage, Michelle Obama came out and gave an amazing fucking speech, which made us all forget what Cory Booker had just said. So you got to feel bad for Cory Booker, right? Ah, poor guy. Gave a great speech. Michelle came out. She gave this speech. Now, if she was running for president, I would vote for her in a fucking heartbeat. And you think to yourself, she's like, wow, this is the First Lady of the United States. She's giving a really great speech. It's an amazing speech. It's hitting all the right notes. It's saying all the right things. It makes me feel good that this is my party. It makes me feel good that this is the, you know, the first lady, the wife of the leader of our party. She was followed by Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders came out. Bernie Sanders is such an enigma. Bernie Sanders is possibly, you know, one of the worst speech faces in history. It's like if you watch him, it's hard to watch. If you hear him, it's a lot easier. Like Bernie Sanders came out and gave his speech. Earlier in the day, he'd been booed by his supporters. He gave his speech. He made his case. I thought it was a good case. I forget the order. I know Elizabeth Warren was in there somewhere. I love Elizabeth Warren. I love Elizabeth Warren. Not the greatest speech giver in the world. That was kind of a milquetoast little speech that she gave. But that's fine. I mean, you know, preaching to the choir here. Democratic delegates out there eating it up. It was a great night. It was a great night of, hey, we have a really progressive platform. Look at our progressive platform, everyone. Hey, everyone, look at our progressive platform. We got an amazing progressive platform. Oh my God, it's Michelle Obama. Look at her. Look at Michelle Obama. Isn't she great? She's great, isn't she? Look at me, I'm Bernie Sanders, and I got this this platform through. And it all went great until Sarah Silverman decided to throw away a line because Paul, what's his name? Bridge Over Troubled Water, dude. Paul Simon wasn't ready to go on. And so Al Franken and Sarah Silverman had to vamp. And she snapped at the Bernie or bust people. You're being ridiculous. It doesn't matter who you are, right? It doesn't matter. Hearing someone tell you that you're being ridiculous. If you're being incredibly passionate about something, hearing someone tell you that you're being ridiculous, it doesn't matter whether she was on your side or not. It's just like, what? Fuck you. Fuck you, bitch. You know how many beers I've had at this point? There's an open bar back here. I mean, it was a cash bar, but it's like, there's a bar here. It's 10 o'clock at night. I've been here since 5. Don't fucking tell me that I'm being ridiculous. You're being ridiculous. You, both of you. That was a double vision joke from them being joke. I know it was really obscure. But then you had a problem on your hand, right? Somebody went off script. Now you got a problem. Now you got a bunch of Bernie or bust people. And remember, these are delegates. These are the most extreme people in our party that we have available to us. Available to? I don't even know what that means. These are really extreme people. Like, they're very passionate. Very, very passionate. But we made it through that evening, right? That evening went okay. And then the next evening. Actually, no, let me back up to that first evening. I think Andrea Mitchell was one that had pointed this out. That there was, the Bernie or bust people were very, very cantankerous during the early part of the day, the early part of the evening. Michelle was basically the turning point. Once Michelle hit the stage, they were even chanting during Cory Booker's speech at one point. But when they, when Michelle got up there, I think that was kind of marked their turning point from the Michelle speech onward that evening. You know, they had calmed down some. A lot of it just came from the fact that there's a lot of misinformation. Like a lot of the Bernie or bust people didn't think that they were going to allow Bernie Sanders to be his name to be entered in the next day, which is a procedural thing, meaning that they wouldn't be able to cast their votes for Bernie Sanders. You know, they wouldn't be able to say, "I, from the state of Nebraska, home of stuff that you'd find in Nebraska, we cast all of our 14 votes for Bernie Sanders," whatever. They felt like they weren't going to be able to say that, right? Their biggest fear came from some rumor that they were just going to bypass all that stuff and just say, you know, we unanimously elect Hillary Clinton and then all votes, you know, I unbound all, I release all my delegates to vote for Hillary Clinton and, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, it wasn't really planned to happen. It had never been planned to happen, but somehow that rumor had gotten around and these people were really upset about it. But I think that was the turning point, is the Michelle speech. So the next night, we get there. We got some more speechifying going on. Time for the big dog. It's time for Bill Clinton to hit the stage. Bill Clinton gave a speech. I haven't seen Bill Clinton give a speech in quite some time. Nor has my cat. He's a big Bill Clinton fan. I thought it was a great speech. I thought it was, you know, he got a lot of flack. All right, not a lot. He got some flack from people saying that, you know, this was a weird speech. It was all concentrating on him meeting his, you know, and how he met his wife and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, it was the kind of speech that you would expect the spouse of a nominee to give. Right? Like if Jean Sanders was up there giving a speech, she probably would have said some stuff too. She's not running for office. She's going to talk about it, but she's going to talk about it in the context of her life with him. And so I think switching those gender roles there, where he was basically talking about his life with her, not as former president of the United States, he would even gloss over, I don't know if you noticed that, but he kind of glossed over those things too. He's like, and then like 2 years later, I can't do a Bill Clinton, so I won't. 2 years later, when I was attorney general, blah, blah, blah. And then 2 years later, when we moved into the governor's mansion, blah, 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 blah. And we moved back. See, he didn't spend a lot of time talking about how he had won those elections or whatever. It was just like he was marking the time of this story. There's a part of me that, oh, Jesus Christ. There's a part of me that wishes that he would have spent longer talking about the elephant in the room. The Monica Lewinsky thing. He kind of made a reference to it, you know, good times and bad times. I kind of wish he would somehow have silenced the people, because you can see these things coming a mile away, right? When you spend enough time listening to crazy right-wing people talk about things, you kind of know where they're going to go. So it's like as soon as Bill Clinton talks about, oh, I met a girl, you know where they're going to go, right? He's an adulterer. Keeping in mind that, you know, all of that stuff was really just, you know, internal marriage politics between him and his wife, which is really none of our fucking business. So it's like, as long as they're cool with things, then why do we, you know, why do we obsess over these things? It's silly. Parker in the chat room says, what could he have even said that would have been useful? I don't know. I don't know what he could have said. Maybe just one extra line about, you know, in some really difficult times, which, you know, we've worked past. It's always darkest before the dawn, and we came out the other side loving each other even more. Something. I don't know. I don't know. I just know that, like, Rachel Maddow didn't even like the speech because she felt that the first part of it was weird. But Bill Clinton gave a great speech. I like Bill's speech a lot. But we were cooking with gas at this point in time, right? We're ready. We're ready to go here. We're cooking with gas. We got Bill Clinton there. He gave his big speech. That was awesome. We got, you know, the Bernie or bust people are not being as vocal, not being as loud. They've been somewhat appeased, and they're behaving. Everything's going the way it should be going, and then suddenly they do this bizarre, just absolutely bizarre Orwellian thing with the monitor where they had all the black and white pictures of all the presidents that had been there. And then the very last picture of Barack Obama shatters into a million pieces of glass as it falls down on the stage. And then there's like the smiling visage of Hillary Clinton looking over us like Big Brother is so fucking weird. It was just such an odd visual that it was just so totally, for me, broke the cadence of the evening. It's just like, what the fuck? What the fuck? Surrounded by a bunch of women and children that she never explained. What was she doing? Where? What? She was in New York, which is only 2 hours away. What was she doing in New York? Why not just come to Philadelphia then, for God's sake? But it's all right. We ended that evening. We move on. We move forward. Stephen Colbert rightly pointed out the Wednesday morning newspapers all had said, you know, the DNC makes history by nominating the first, being the first major political party to nominate a woman. And on every single paper that he showed had a picture of Bill Clinton on the front page, because that was who gave the speech that night. So it's just a weird thing. I get that the glass shattering down, someone in the chat room is saying that shattering the imaginary glass. I get that. But it was just such a weird, with no real prompting, it just kind of happened. And she was in bright Technicolor and they were there, and it was just odd. And it led to those headlines the next day, right? Great headlines with really bad visuals. Someone corrected it, because the next night, Wednesday night, or as I like to call it, All-Star Night, got to hear from our buddy, old buddy Joe. This is just, me. Here, I'm sorry, let me take a slip of beer. I would give a substantial amount of money to meet Joe Biden. And I don't mean like photo op meet Joe Biden. I mean like have a dinner, right, with Joe Biden. Just talk to Joe Biden. Just hang out with Joe Biden. He seems like such an awesome guy. You know what I'm saying? Just like, it's Joe Biden. Man's been in politics for, 200 years. Nobody hates him. Everyone loves him. Both sides of the aisles. He's great. He was on Morning Joe on Wednesday morning before he gave a speech that night. And he made a comment. It was a story. Let's be honest. It's Joe Biden. He doesn't make comments. He makes stories. He was talking about how when he first started in the Senate, he was taking the tour and there was the cafeteria, the Senate cafeteria. And there was the general room, which had a whole bunch of individual tables. And that would be where you would go with your guests or whatever. But then there was another dining room that was for senators only. And it was a big, long table. It was the room for Senate. And that's where people went to eat. It was this big, didn't matter if they were Republican, Democrats, whatever. They went to eat at this shared table in this big room. And he was reminiscing about that and how difficult it is to call someone an evil, horrible person when you sit across and eat lunch with them. Or when your kids go to the same school as they do. Or you go on trips together for Senate business. Now, there was a time that's not that long ago in our country where Democrats and Republicans worked together. They were ideologically opposed to one another, but they were people trying to do the business of government, trying to work their things out. It was Newt Gingrich that actually made the Republican senator stop going to the shared lunchroom. He was saying that when he went back to the lunchroom, a couple of months ago, or maybe a year ago, it wasn't there anymore. That room was no longer there. That's like it's now been turned into a regular dining room. That doesn't even exist anymore. Anyway, I digress. The Joe gives his speech. Only Joe Biden can end a speech with, "Come on!" It was angry Joe at the end of the speech there. Come on! Joe gave his speech. Part of Biden's speech was a little aside at the beginning. It's like he was talking to Barack earlier and they no longer had to wonder who was going to make the best speech at the convention, because Michelle had already done it. And that held true. That held true. Oh, that's right. Parker's pointing out that he used the favorite word, malarkey. He used his word malarkey in that speech. And that was. Michelle giving this best speech was malarkey, because Barack Obama came out and gave the best speech that I've ever heard Barack Obama give. And I've heard all of Barack Obama's speeches. And you're there just thinking to yourself, like, wow, this guy is great. This guy is smart. This guy is great. This is an amazing speech. I'm really, really, really enjoying this. And he did a thing that hadn't been done up to that point. Prior to Barack speaking, or President Obama speaking, different speakers would come out and they would name Donald Trump by name. Donald Trump thinks that people that have bad hair pieces should get tax breaks. Well, we don't believe that. Donald Trump is a madman. But Barack didn't do that. He didn't go after Donald Trump. He went after Donald Trump's beliefs. Far more powerful, far more effective. Barack Obama gave a speech that not only put into perspective his own presidency, that not only set up the handing of the baton forward to another candidate of his party that would continue with his work, but a good majority of his speech made a case for Republicans to vote for Hillary Clinton. A really strong case for them to vote for Hillary Clinton. It was a ridiculously good speech. It's one of those, it's going to be talked about for years. It's going to be dissected for years. It was such an amazing speech. And at the end of that speech, someone had finally told Hillary, you can't just show up on a big screen. You need to be on stage. Hillary comes out. The place goes wild. Amazing, amazing night. Foreshadowing to the end of my little bit here, they should have just ended the convention then. Thursday morning papers had the picture that we wanted to see. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton. There you go. Headline matches picture. Here's your candidate. Not only that, you had all kinds of Republicans coming out and saying that, wow, Obama kind of got me thinking last night. You know what? I may just skip voting for president. Or maybe I'll secretly just toss her the vote because this other guy kind of bonkers. Thursday was upon us. Thursday was the day that Hillary Clinton was going to give her speech. Yes, my cat is upset about that as well. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Yes. And I was there. I watched. I saw you guys on Twitter. I saw you guys talking about how great it was and how wonderful she did. And I would make a side comment about like, oh, well, I guess presidential candidates are like Star Trek films, only every other one is good at giving speeches. Which I thought was a clever line. But I got all kind of like blowback on that. Why would she's just not good. She's not good at giving speeches. She's good at a lot of things. She's great at a lot of things. Giving rousing speeches is not one of them. That's fine. Right? She's like that member of the boy band that just can't quite carry the tune or just can't quite get the dance steps. Did you ever think that like Lance Bass, like just never quite got the dance steps down? Now, was that a case that Lance Bass wasn't that good or is that a case that Justin Timberlake was just really great? You know, I don't know. But here was the thing. Barack Obama had set it up for me on Wednesday night. Wednesday night, I went to bed thinking, all right, maybe I won't leave that box blank. Maybe I will. Maybe I will vote for Hillary. And They should have just ended then, because it's Thursday night. She came out and gave this speech. These aren't my numbers. I don't do the numbers, right? I just rely on what I read. She mentioned Donald Trump by name 22 times. She spent an inordinate amount of time telling me why I shouldn't vote for Donald Trump, something that I had never, ever planned on doing in the first place. Never. I never planned on voting for Donald Trump. None of the Bernie or bust people were going to vote for Donald Trump. There was no one that she was speaking to that was going to vote for Donald Trump. So to spend the majority of her speech explaining that you should vote for me because I'm not Donald Trump is not a convincing argument. I needed to hear why I should vote for her. I needed her to tell me why I should give her my vote. What is it she's going to do to get my vote? Not what he's doing. I don't care what he's... I'm not voting for him. I have no interest in voting for him. I want to know what you're going to do. And that's such a weird, nuanced thing to me, but that is what separates a presidential candidate from a surrogate. Your surrogates go out. They do the attacking. They're the ones that say, you know, Donald Trump is an idiot. You don't do that. You're there to be presidential. You're there to be a statesman or a statesperson. The president of the United States is a lot of things. He's the commander-in-chief, or she is the commander-in-chief of the military. He or she is the head statesman. A Secretary of State. But I'm just saying, for the rest of the world, we look at they look at our president as kind of like being our statesperson. There's the chief executive officer. There's a lot of things that the president can do. A lot of the things that she was talking about are not even things that the president can do. These are things that Congress and the Senate have to make laws for. Sure, she can not veto them. She can help sign them into law. Maybe she could nudge her party, if in power, to enact that legislation. But there's a very plausible chance that if she does win, that she will not have a Democratic majority in the Congress and the Senate. And then what? You're not going to be able to encourage your party, the minority party, to introduce legislation. Do you think the Republicans are going to just like suddenly want to work with us? Tell me why. Tell me why I should vote for you. Don't tell me why I shouldn't vote for the other guy. And that was, to me, was the most tragic mistake of her speech. It just didn't bring it home for me. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know if I'm going to vote for her. I'm still really tempted to leave that little particular block blank. If I could vote for Barack again, I'd do it in a second. Mags in the chat room is saying, if they think having a black man was bad, wait until they have a woman with a Republican-controlled Congress. Actually, I'm going to disagree with you there, Mags. I think black person was totally like their worst fucking nightmare. Yeah, that's a woman, but at least she's white. I could see them saying that. I know it's not popular to say, but I really don't think it's... I mean, it is historic. It is historic to have a female nominee of a major party. And we have to keep qualifying and saying a major party because there's been female presidential nominees before. Just, I mean, one back in the 1800s, right? It's like for the Equal Rights Party, a non-viable party that actually fielded a presidential candidate. But having a woman leader of a country... it's not a groundbreaking thing. There's plenty of women leaders in the country. I think most people over the age or under the age of, let's say, 80 are perfectly comfortable with a woman leader. I don't think it's that big of a holdup. I could be wrong. Maybe I surround myself with people of like mindsets. but it just doesn't seem like it's this huge history-making event. Now, I'm not a woman. Right? Like, I think if we had an LGBT candidate, I don't know. I don't know how I'd feel. Groundbreaking, but not groundbreaking in the way that it's like, oh my God, this has never happened before. I don't know. I know. I can hear you asking the question. You're asking a question, Daniel, who is the LGBT leader of a country that you're talking about? I have no idea. But I'm just saying. So there you go. I had fun watching both conventions. I had fun listening to them. I'm hoping that she'll make that case for me. That she'll lead me home. Lead me home, Hillary. One thing I wanted to point out. I know a lot of people get really, really angry. I'm going to couch this in the story of me being a smoker. I started smoking cigarettes when I was 18 years old. Maybe 17, 18. And I smoked cigarettes for up until the time I was, 43? Quite a long time I smoked cigarettes. You should stop that. That's bad for you. I heard that. I saw those commercials on TV. This is what your lung looks like after you smoke. Saw all of those insane anti-smoking ads that were designed to shock you into stopping smoking. None of those things worked. If you talk to most people that quit smoking, I'm going to guess, don't know for sure, but I'm going to guess, at least anecdotally, that none of them quit smoking because they saw a commercial that grossed them out. It's not like people that smoke cigarettes are ignorant to the fact that it is damaging their body. It is not a lack of information that causes people to choose to continue or to discontinue smoking. That's just not an issue. They're not uninformed. Or maybe they're uninformed on the absolute, you know, every possible disease that they could possibly get, but it's not like they think that this is some kind of health thing. This isn't the 1930s or 40s when we had Chesterfield sponsoring shows and talking about 4 out of 5 doctors recommend Lucky Strikes, whatever. Has nothing to do with that. Shocking people and trying to make people feel bad about the habits that they have or the addictions that they have is not going to get them to change their behavior. It's just not. It's not like they don't know it. The thing that made me stop smoking was moving to Connecticut and realizing that cigarettes up here cost $11.50 a pack. It was going to be $110 a week for me to keep smoking. $440 a month. At the time, my husband smoked. So it was going to be $880 a month to continue smoking. That was what caused me to stop smoking. Not fear of my health, not crazy ads on television. Had to do with the bottom line. Had to do with the pocketbook. It had to do with it. And most people do things, you know, for their own survival, i.e. pocketbook issues. Pocketbook, that's why that's a phrase. That's why we even have that phrase in the English language, pocketbook issues. These are the basic things that kind of drive us into doing things. Telling us that Donald Trump is crazy is not going to change anyone's view. They know he's crazy. They know he's crazy. They know he's batshit crazy. They like the fact that he's batshit crazy. You gotta make it matter. You gotta draw the line that shows what he's doing is directly affecting their pocketbook issues. Something that Obama did in his speech But at least keep that in mind. The next time that you want to, like, forward one of those memes on Facebook, you know, the ones with the Willy Wonka looking at you, oh, so you say you're not going to vote for Hillary. Tell me again how you support Donald Trump blowing up the country with his nuclear hair. I don't know why it came out as horror. Because if anything, it's just going to make them dig in deeper. I don't know. Let me repeat that. Please make a note of this. I don't know. But I suspect that a lot of the Burn Your Bust people are exactly like me. They're just looking for a reason to vote for Hillary. You don't need to tell them that they're being idiots or they're being assholes or whatever it is. That's not going to help the matter at all. If you really want to win over that final 10 or 15% of Bernie or Bust supporters, then give a good reason why we should vote for Hillary Clinton. And here, spoiler alert, a good reason is not she's not Donald Trump. There's a lot of people. There's what, 320 million people in the United States that are not Donald Trump. Doesn't make them qualified to be president. Anyway. I thank you for indulging me in my little political talk tonight. Adam's not going to listen to this. If you have thoughts on this and you would like to email me, please do. DanielJBrewer@gmail.com. I don't know when I'm going to get... Maybe I'll put out another little political show in the future. I don't know. Maybe I'm just tricking myself into thinking that me sitting here blowing off shit is somehow entertaining. And it's not. I don't know. We, and by we, I mean Dubious Intent, will not be on next week. I'm going to be in Vegas for the Star Trek convention, but we will be back the weekend after that. So what is that? Next weekend is the 7th of August. We'll be back August 14th. August 14th, we will be back here on Pride48.com, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Kind of feel I don't want to play the Dubious Intent outro because this really isn't a Dubious Intent show. Oh, I know what I can play. I can play it. There you go. Thank you so much. It's like, I'm so glad that you were here to open up with me. Open up. Open up. Ah! Open up. Yeah.